Williams Bay, Delavan Darien, Bigfoot Union High School, and Whitewater. Referendums to increase tax levies for municipal spending passed in Sugar Creek, but lost in Bloomfield. 8:10, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD sports and weather. The NBA, the Bucks lose to Portland 118-103 last night. Bulls had the night off. The Bucks are off tonight. The Bulls play in New Orleans. NHL, Blackhawks off last night. They are off again tonight. Now the WGTD Wednesday forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy, windy, and brisk. Today's high 43 with winds up to 20 miles per hour. Right now, wind is from the west at 20, 35 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is the 7th of November. It is the day after midterm elections, as if you didn't know. And I am really, really grateful to be sitting across the table this morning from two faculty colleagues at Carthage College, Dr. Jeff Roberg, Dr. Jerry Mast. Dr. Mast, by the way, is on sabbatical right now, but kindly coming out of sabbatical, so to speak, to be one of two guests today to offer some analysis on what turned out to be kind of a complicated midterm election, and of course very exciting, at least in the extent of voter turnout, which was extraordinarily high, and lots of things happened all over the country, and even right here in Wisconsin, it's kind of a complicated and interesting picture by the results. And so we have a lot to talk about. So without further ado, we welcome Professor Jerry Mast, Professor Jeff Roberg to the morning show. Thanks for being here, gentlemen.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
So how late were you up watching returns last night?
Just past one. Just when they called the Evers race, Evers Walker.
I mean, it's about 1:30 or so, yeah.
So you're tougher than Jeff then, okay.
We've always known that.
I got things keeping me up at night.
Right. So I'm really curious, first of all, as a real general comment from both of you, how surprised are you by what ensued last night? Or did we end up, at least generally speaking, with something at least remotely resembling what you kind of thought we would end up with after these elections were done?
Regarding Wisconsin or regarding
overall, just big picture.
Overall, we clearly have to say it was a good night for the Democrats. I can't say I'm overly surprised in the scheme of things. Democrats had a really tough road in the Senate. So those that were predicting some kind of a Senate flip were clearly more than optimistic in trying to make that happen. The House was certainly within a reasonable shot And frankly, the happiest person in the country has to be Tom Perez right now. They fielded some good candidates, more broadly speaking, especially in most of the vulnerable spots. We'll talk, obviously, about the first district here later. But overall, in terms of the country, the Democrats have to be ecstatic, picking up seven governorships. And Georgia is still kind of on the edge there for the moment. And then in terms of diversity that came through, I think it's a good time for the country. I think it says a lot about not just for the Dems, but the Republicans, that in one sense, the parties are still relatively strong, although the parties are definitely changing. And we can talk about that more later as well. But were there some surprises? Sure. But overall, I think it went just about to how at least I had envisioned.
Yeah, I guess I would agree with most of that. I might push a little bit on whether it's a good time for the country. It's a complicated and an interesting one. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a mixed picture. I liked Rahm Emanuel's characterization of the election. He said last night, it was a blue wave with a really strong red undertow. And so, I think that there are elements of what transpired last night that both sides can take some comfort from.
Yeah.
I guess where I'm a little hesitant to say that kind of from the big picture, from the country's perspective, that it's a good thing, I would say that given that both sides can feel cheered in a way, it does in fact represent real fundamental tensions and differences within the country. And so one of the things I was interested in finding out was, and I guess I don't know for sure yet, as a social scientist, I'd like to look at the data and think about it for a while. But I was interested to see what impact President Trump would have on some of these races, given the unconventional approach to the midterms that he took. Presidents have in recent history stepped in to the midterm process and championed their party to a point, but there's been a kind of agreed upon level of discreteness, an agreed upon level of partisanship that presidents engage in, and all the gloves, of course, came off. I'm not sure they were ever on with respect to Mr. Trump. Very, very, very partisan, very, very abrasive and divisive. I think objectively we can say very dishonest approach to campaigning on behalf of the Republican Party. And I guess it raised a load of questions about, well, is he going to harm his party's interests? Is he playing into the hands of the Democrats, or is this actually going to work for Republicans? And the answers to that are complex. I think that the net effect was to help the Democrats in kind of places they needed to be helped, like suburbs in particular, with more educated voters. And it made certain red areas of the country redder. And it, I think, helped the Republicans in some areas, particularly in the Senate, which is increasingly dependent upon, rural, small town kinds of folks. Mm.
Professor Roberg, you said right off the bat that this was always very much an uphill battle for the Democrats to regain the Senate. I mean, that anybody who was expecting that was really expecting something that was almost certainly not going to happen. What was it about that was so different from, for instance, the Democrats' desire and ultimately success in taking back the House? What makes the Senate a different undertaking?
So as your listeners know, of course, we had roughly a third of the Senate up for re-election. But the majority of those seats were at the moment, well, at the moment are still, were and are currently Democratic held, which means that a number of those seats, more Democratic seats, had to be defended
yeah.
versus Republican seats. Then take on that, we had about 10 seats where President Trump won those states by almost, in some cases, double digits or almost double digits.
So very red pockets
right.
of the country.
Right? And yeah. so some of the early losses, like Heidi Heitkamp. Was,
Joe Donnelly.
Right.
McCaskill in Missouri.
Yeah, those were you know, pretty, those were going to be really tough roads to go for the Democrats, and they proved to be so.
Right. As opposed to the House, in which every 2 years they're all up, right? And so
right.
The map doesn't change in that respect. It's the
it's whole got other
country,
issues.
Right. There are definitely other issues, but uh-huh. but the map for the Senate is different every 2 years. It's another different third of the Senate seats that are up, and you know, chance had it that the Democrats had to defend way more seats than the Republicans.
Interesting.
So if your Democratic listeners are saying, well, what about us then for future, right? Think 2020, 2022, the map becomes more favorable
right.
to the Democrats.
Interesting. For those of you just joining us with me today on the morning show is Dr. Jeff Roberg, Dr. Jerry Mast, both from the political science faculty at Carthage College. We're obviously going to be talking about last night and all that happened. I certainly want to talk more about the national scene, but I think we need to not delay any longer, turning our attention to Wisconsin and, of course, to the headline race that had both of you up into the morning, namely, of course, the hotly contested race for governor, in which it appears the incumbent, Scott Walker, has been defeated by his Democratic challenger, Tony Evers. Professor Mast, I think it was you who mentioned before we even went on the air, in a sense, an interesting irony that hangs over the prospect of a recount in this really tight race. Explain what makes this kind of an ironic turn of events for incumbent Governor Walker.
Well, the last numbers I saw on the spread between the two candidates was 1.2%. Mr. Evers is ahead by 1.2%. Last year, Governor Walker and the Republicans in the state legislature passed a law that made recounts. You can only have a recount for an election so long as it's within a 1 percentage point difference. And so it could be that if this lead holds up, that Mr. Walker is not entitled to a recount by virtue of the law that he and his party passed last year.
Hmm. So what do you think was, as far as we can tell from polling and so on, what do we think were the key ingredients to this victory of Tony Evers over Scott Walker?
I think we have to think local on a number of aspects. I think there's a long list of potential reasons, and like Professor Mast, I want to see a little more data on it. But what the Marquette Law School poll and others have been telling us for some time is that and this is Tip O'Neill's old line of all races are local, is infrastructure, potholes, healthcare,
schools
that, you know, the $200 that Governor Walker has put into the schools per child this year is not making up, of course, for the shortfalls over the last several years of his budgets. And I think we can take that for sure, because a number of communities around the state had referenda on their ballot that asked, will you allow us to tax you a little bit more in order to pay for schools? And at least all the ones that I've seen, I'm sure there's some that I haven't, have said resounding yes.
Right.
Yeah,
and that
it's
locals, local people recognize
right.
that
right.
there's a problem here when it comes to schools.
Right.
I think we also have taken into account fatigue factor.
Schools and roads, I think, are really key in Wisconsin, and healthcare. And I'm just going to push back a little bit. Mr. O'Neill is wrong. Tip O'Neill is wrong. Not all politics are local. I think, and increasingly, politics are more national, being more nationalized. But some politics are, in fact, local. And I think that Professor Roberg's absolutely right about the issues that are were relevant to the gubernatorial race. Fatigue matters. I mean, I think that Scott Walker deserves a great deal of credit for building up a powerful party machine in this state. The Republican Party has been dominant. I think that's a fair term in Wisconsin. Outside of a couple of fairly gerrymandered districts at the congressional level, and up until 2016, presidential politics have narrowly been going to the Democrats in Wisconsin. The one kind of key statewide exception that we can talk about in a moment or two, I think, is Ms. Baldwin, who's been able to maintain a pretty successful position here in the state. In any event, Mr. Walker, as successful as he's been over the last 8 years, is a very polarizing figure. And I think he and the Republicans in the state legislature have made a decision that they have the reins of government. They're gonna govern, and they're governing not for the median voter. They're certainly not governing for Democrats in Wisconsin. They're governing for conservatives in Wisconsin, and they've been practicing a very kind of base oriented approach to running the government, and they essentially made a calculation that they don't care if Democrats don't like them much, and they have been very capable when it comes to electioneering to pull this off. In a way, I think that where the fatigue has been amplified in Wisconsin for Mr. Walker, you can't divorce it from the national scene. I think Wisconsin was a hotbed of rising Republican stars. You had Mr. Walker, of course. You had Paul Ryan, vice presidential nominee in 2012, chair of the budget committee, kind of the rock star whiz kid amongst the policy wonks on the right, and then Speaker of the House. You had Reince Priebus, who was the chair of the Republican National Committee and then the chief of staff in the White House. And Mr. Trump has really, really tarnished all three men's careers. He's very, very critical of Mr. Ryan, has made life very hard on Mr. Ryan in the House, treated Mr. Priebus, I think, enormously unfairly, very, 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 very poorly. And of course, Trump took the nomination in 2016 away from, from amongst a number of people, Mr. Walker. And so I think that although Mr. Trump won Wisconsin in 2016 narrowly, the fatigue with Mr. Walker was amplified by feelings that Mr. Trump has engendered amongst the both independents and Democrats.
I'm going to largely agree with Dr. Mast, but I want to push my turn to push back just slightly.
Push away.
And that is that what I would argue is that in the governor's race, largely speaking, I would argue that President Trump wasn't a factor in terms of if we look at how Tony Evers was campaigning, he decided to campaign really on local type issues. And particularly his closing, how he closed the campaign in the last 2 weeks was, hey, I'm your guy, I'm one of you, I'm local. And it was actually some of the ads that came from elsewhere, right, that pushed more of the Scott Walker being, he was more concerned about the national picture or whatnot. So my argument is just that in terms of how Evers ran the election, that he really ran more of a local-based you know, these are the issues that you guys care about. As far as Governor Walker, you have kind of a mix. Part of it was, I'm your local guy, and certainly we see a number of things that he was trying to push during the campaign to say, yes, I'm still, you know, Wisconsinite, I'm still local. But also, at the same time, saying, look, I have a friend in D.C., he can help us and such. But so that's the only area I would really...
I think that's fair, especially with respect to tone. I guess I would just defend a little bit the position that Trump matters here in that turnout is so high.
Absolutely.
Right? I mean, turnout so high.
Absolutely.
Amongst Democrats and independents. And I think that you know, much of that, Wisconsin's a high turnout state regardless.
Mm-hmm. We're higher than average, you mean?
Yes,
higher than
very
average.
Much.
Way higher than average. And I think local issues absolutely are what many people were on their minds. But I think that the higher turnout, the normal for a midterm, is a reflection of the polarized national scene.
And I'd agree with that. I want to be clear, right? I think those things in some ways can be divorced in terms of turnout, in terms of what the president has driven versus how the campaigns were run for governor.
Absolutely correct. Evers, I think, made a smart calculation that I'm not going to talk about the national thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about Mr. Trump. And he assumed that it would happen, work to his favor anyway.
Right.
Right? He didn't need to talk about them.
Right.
Correct. I'm going to focus on the local.
So in other words, he could have made the choice to say, if you hate President Trump, vote for me. His calculation, that would have made absolutely no sense.
He had nothing to gain there.
Right. Because he's also trying to attract independents in the process, right? And you don't want to push independents the other way. So all of us have this visceral reaction to all of the TV advertisements, right? And at some point, perhaps you have the same thing. You hear the TV ad, the same ones over and over again, and they're saying that your candidate is this horrible human being, and you know, instinctively you go, oh, I want to vote for that person. That sounds great. Yeah.
Right. By the way, I want to make sure before I forget, somebody mentioned something about this high voter turnout, and somebody had mentioned before we went on the air that traditionally, Democrats, those towards the left, tend to be the voters who do not turn out at midterms, more so than Republicans.
Normally, yeah. So, I mean, we have elections every 2 years, every four, right? It's a presidential election, and those generate far more interest, far more attention, far more media coverage and so forth, and naturally those elections have higher turnout. In between presidential elections are the midterms, and you know they don't generate as high turnouts as presidential years. And so there's variation. Sometimes the midterms are higher, then sometimes they're lower as far as turnout goes. This one's higher. It's not quite to the level of a presidential election, but higher for
pretty
sure.
Close.
And when it comes to the parties, right? So I mean, historically, Republicans there's been fewer of them than Democrats in this country, but they've offset that numerical disadvantage at least some by being more reliable at turning out. And Democrats, which have historically they've drawn from more working class folks with less education, their turnout and racial minorities, their turnout has been less reliable. So when turnout is high in the midterms, normally that favors the Democrats because it reflects this pool of people who often sit out midterm elections, but for whatever reasons are now stepping in.
And
in the same way, right, this year we had Milwaukee step back into the fray, right, where you had about 17,000 people that you know, didn't show up, let's say, from Milwaukee in 2016. We have traditionally, Wisconsin has very high turnout here. So in 2016, we had the fifth highest turnout in the country.
Wow.
In 2014, we had good turnout. We had good turnout this year. This is where the national scene, and particularly President Trump, energized a lot of people to come out. And your listeners can decide what issue made them decide to vote, whether it was, you know, President Trump in general, or it was the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, or whatever the case might be. But clearly, this was a case of the president certainly helping turnout in many ways. And we see this also in terms of early voting. So in Wisconsin, we had 565,000 plus people do early voting or absentee ballots and in the state, which was ahead of what it was, say, in 2014 by over 20%.
Wow. And that's consistent with national trends. Mm-hmm. All the states, many of the states are moving towards facilitating earlier voting. There's some pushback. Mm-hmm. Some states have actually curtailed that. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Tammy Baldwin's decisive victory last night. How do we make sense of those numbers, given some of what else was going on in the state? What do you think is the key to her decisive victory?
Well, the numbers tell us that some people voted for Tammy Baldwin and Scott Walker, right? I mean, the difference between their vote totals can only be explained by people splitting their ticket in that regard. We do – this is a shout-out to the Marquette Law School poll and Charles Franklin. The folks up there had this pegged.
Yes.
They had a really close tied race for the governors, and they had a comfortable lead for Ms. Baldwin. And I think – you know, the most of the polls suggested something like that, although Marquette's numbers were right on target. Those of us who follow the polls have been able to think about this a little bit in advance. Why would this be, right? And I think it's largely a result of Ms. Baldwin's it's a number of things, but Ms. Baldwin's her approach to office and constituency services. She's a very conscientious practitioner of constituency services. She's a bit of an economic populist. So in a way, you can find some on economic issues connections between her and people who probably voted for Mr. Trump. She's protective of Wisconsin industries like dairy and military bases in the state. And so there are going to be people who are comfortable with Ms. Baldwin, despite her being very liberal, not because of it. Certainly, there'll be people who are comfortable with her because she's a liberal, but comfortable with her despite her liberalism because she does work hard at trying to protect kind of key material interests that are relevant to voters in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. How about then the first congressional district going the way it was? Of course, that's traditionally been a Republican district, so the victory of a Republican in that district is in and of it itself not a huge surprise. How about the margin of victory in this case?
So this is one of those that those cases that we can frankly use in classes we teach, and in some ways it honestly wasn't unexpected, at least not for me.
The margin of victory.
The margin of victory and who is going to win. And the reason I say that is that there are certain demographic aspects that are consistent, or at least relatively consistent. This district has changed over the last 20 years in terms of who's been moving in, who's been moving out, how the job situation has changed. Your listeners well know, of course, if you think of who we were as a district in terms of some auto plants and blue-collar jobs, right? Those are largely gone. We can argue about Foxconn, but it's not here yet. And those jobs appear to be leaning these days about 70% white-collar. Brings in a different type of voter in that regard. The other thing has to do with what I would call, frankly, the perennial weakness of the Democratic Party in this district in terms of pulling up candidates. And so I can promise any candidate in a normal district that you'll get 30 to 35% of the vote.
No matter who you are.
No matter who you are. By putting a D or an R next to your name, I can guarantee you 30 to 35% of the vote.
Maybe more. these days.
And what when I teach, I teach that, yes, money matters to an extent, but money is not the decider.
Once so you pass the threshold, then
that's
it's,
right.
it doesn't matter.
So Bryce had roughly a 3-to-1 advantage over Style in terms of cash. But the key was
they both
that
passed the threshold.
They both passed the threshold, and Style had enough money to get his message out.
Right.
And frankly, I think in terms of the debates that we saw that happened, Carthage sponsored one of those, and there were a couple of others Bryce showed his limitations in terms of some of the policy ideas that he mm-hmm. had in the scheme of things. Other thing that your voters might may or may not take solace in is, at least for Kenosha County, the county itself still leans Democrat. You're looking that way, about 4-5% used to be much larger, right? But nonetheless, and that's the point, right? The demographics have changed over time so that for whoever is going to run in this seat, the Republican at the moment, until at least we do some reapportionment in terms of the congressional districts in 2020, 2021, the Republicans are going to have the advantage here.
Yeah, and I agree with all that. And I would just add that, like Ms. Baldwin is a competent politician. Paul Ryan is a very talented politician and has established a kind of a relationship with enough constituents here in the first congressional district to create coattails in a way, right? I mean, he's stepping down, but he's leaving a legacy of expectation, right? And so Mr. Style stepped in to that with a kind of a promise to continue, right, this kind of representation that a clear majority of the voters in the first congressional district are comfortable with.
Let's turn our attention back to the national scene into a couple of important matters, one of them being the year of the woman, as I think Donna Shalala phrased it, the fact that we have this dramatic influx of women into the political fray, I mean, more than we have seen before, and more of them winning. And just the face of Capitol Hill changing in a rather dramatic way. Help us understand the scope and significance of what is happening here.
Well, there has been historically a gender gap when it comes to political behavior. Women have, on average, favored Democrats. Men have favored Republicans. That's grown recently. And it's really grown in this last cycle. Women overwhelmingly are preferring Democrats. And so if we could come up with a to-do list for the Republican Party, they're going to have to really think hard about what it is that they can do to appeal to women in the suburbs in particular. Otherwise, they're in trouble. As far as we're going to have a historic number of women in the Congress, over 100
Native American women.
Yes, two Native. So 1/3 of all of the people running, nominated by the Democrats, were women of color.
Yeah.
Right.
Really.
Yes, 1/3 of every Democratic candidate who won nomination for a congressional seat was a woman of color, and this is. Reflective of demographic shifts that people we've been talking about for years, and I think explain a fair amount of what's going on in both parties. Right, you have increasing kind of social liberalism on the part of the Democratic Party, a comfort level with diversity, an embrace of changing kind of social norms around things like gender roles, gender identity, sexual orientation, things like that, immigration. And on the other side of the aisle, you have a Republican Party that is increasingly, I think, characterized by a kind of a white identity movement in which there is concern about change in the country. Political scientists Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Weiler at the University of North Carolina have some pretty persuasive research on this recently, in which they characterize kind of development in the political culture in terms of a couple of different perspectives. They call it kind of a fixed worldview versus a fluid worldview. And increasingly, Democrats are falling into this category of fluid worldview, in which you're open to change, you embrace change, you're comfortable with diversity. And Republicans are increasingly more characterized by a fixed worldview, in which you're more comfortable with tradition, you're afraid of a change or resistant to change, and you view diversity as more dangerous than potentially positive. And so I think that as women are stepping up into these what have been historically for them, you know, male domains, psychologically, some people are okay with that, and some people are uncomfortable with it. And that kind of psych.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
As you were saying, Professor Mass.
Well, I don't see it as an emergency, but society is changing. Culturally, right? Socially. And individuals' reaction to those changes varies, right? Some people are more comfortable with these changes. Some people are less comfortable with these changes. And that those differences in terms of psychological reaction are expressing themselves in partisan identity, right? And so, you know, clearly some prominent Republican women have risen in the ranks. So it's not like Republicans are opposed to women being successful. Marsha Blackburn in Tennessee, very conservative member of Congress, won Bob Corker's seat last night. So, I mean, Republicans aren't opposed to women per se. But as women are moving into and changing, you know, gender roles and so forth, and pushing a platform of social change, you know, Democrats are the more likely vehicle through which they're going to pursue those kinds of political ambitions, and we're definitely seeing that.
Interesting. One of the stories I was reading this morning was about Beto O'Rourke going down to narrow defeat to Ted Cruz down in Texas. But this article pointed to the fact that even some of these races where the Democratic candidate was unsuccessful, that there was still a big story there, particularly in a place like Texas and in a race that just a couple of years ago would have been won handily by any Republican who would have run. So what do we take away from races like that?
So, end of median voter theory.
I'll let you handle that. I'll take a couple of practical lessons away, which is first of all, getting back to an earlier point that we talked about. So the Beto O'Rourke is interesting to me because here you had a candidate again that had in this case a number of a good message. It was a good package in terms of the person who was delivering the message. Really caught on. Particularly, we see that in the fundraising. And so he had so much money in the scheme of things. But again, this is a case, right, where, you know, in the popular lore, well, you have to have, you know, all this money. That's, you know, at the end of the day, there are certain things that limit whether you can win or not. We've both phrased it earlier as you have to have sufficient money, but money on its own is not going to make up for the demographic challenges of whatever district you have and whatnot. So that's number one. Number two is the the opposite of that, if you will. So in the past, the Republicans have been the main money raisers for different campaigns and have usually outraised the Democrats by quite a bit, whether it be nationally or in some cases, well, most cases, locally. And this is one of those times where that did not hold true. So then the question becomes is, since the Democrats are so energized and clearly are willing to reach into their pockets in the midterms to, if you will, say no to some of the policies of the president or local candidates or whatnot, what does that bode for 2020, which I'm sorry to your listeners, actually just began this morning. So hold on to your hats, and we'll see that. There are larger questions too, though, and we see this at least initially in some of the exit polling data, which I'm there's more that has to be done here, but at least on the initial exit polling that we're seeing, because the exit polls don't take into account, for instance, all the absentee ballots and whatnot of the folks that voted early. So with that proviso, I want to just lay out two kind of markers. We've been predicting for a number of years now that Latinos would show up in massive numbers as their numbers
grow
suggest.
In the population. Yeah.
This race, as in 2016, shows again that Latinos underperformed as a voting bloc. Only 11% showed up. They should be in the range of about 19-20%. For what they represent within the country. We were also promised by a number of groups that were out there. One of them was NextGen, and there's some others as well, talking about trying to get young people to vote. This is the perennial voting bloc that, if they showed up,
yeah, they're the biggest cohort, age
they,
cohort.
They would have a tremendous influence. 18 to 29-year-olds showed up at 13% this time.
Yeah.
Really? So again, we run into these kind of demographic issues that say things should theoretically favor the Democrats, right? If folks carried through, and that's not where we are.
Not yet. And I'll add to that. Conventional political thinking suggests, right, that in these kinds of environments, general election, you want to be competitive, you move to the center, right? To run a more moderate kind of a candidate who will appeal to the independents, who will appeal to the maybe some of the disaffected people on the other side of the aisle in order to succeed in the general election. Beto O'Rourke's not a centrist, right? Neither is Andrew Gillum. Neither is Stacey Abrams. These are people more on the left. And so I would argue that the Republican Party kind of forged this new approach of forsaking the center by running conservative candidates for these elections several cycles ago, at least. And the Democrats are starting to mimic that kind of electoral strategy. And, you know, So is there a surprise in the O'Rourke Cruz contest? For sure. A progressive, somebody as progressive as O'Rourke almost won the Senate seat, right? That's that is at least a moral victory. And you can say, hey, you know, if you're a liberal, that is a moral victory. If you're a Democrat, that's a moral victory. The logic behind the conventional perspective is that, well, if you have a normally distributed electorate, by normal, a bell-shaped curve, most of the people in the center and the tails in the distribution kind of tailing off, then most of the votes are near the center, center-left, center-right, right? But increasingly, it's not clear that we have a normal distribution in the electorate. And so as the political culture polarizes, you know, it's kind of an all bets are off kind of situation in which you can win if you're very conservative, if the circumstances are right and you play your cards well. You can win if you're a progressive, if the circumstances are right and you play your cards well. And it might be that if you're a centrist or a moderate, you have no expectation that that's somehow going to help you.
And I'll just add to that slightly in the sense that it really in many ways depends on where you are and what you're running for in terms of the country.
Right. So like where you live. You
so
mean.
Tony correct, Evers, right, right. The way he was
here,
successful
local politics
last
matters,
night
right.
Was he was able to chip off some of those independent voters that had voted for Scott Walker
right. Quite a few
in the past,
yeah.
Right? About 4 or 5%
yeah.
Actually went, you know, towards Evers. We'll see the total numbers later. But so, if, you know, again, here's a case where depending upon what your race is, you may see something else. And then you've got a place like Kansas, right? Which one would think if you looked at it before the race began, you say, oh, well, this is going, you know, Republican. Right. There's no question right. here. But then you have a candidate like Kobach.
Who clearly overplayed the
right.
kind of the Trumpist kind
exactly.
of extreme. Right. So there's a limit to how far you can go.
Which is good news, right?
Right. If you're worried about polarization, right, you can be heartened by that. Whereas also in the case of congressional race in Kansas, Native American woman, openly gay,
right.
Knocked off a Republican incumbent. So, you know, there's a lot of
there's
interesting
a lot to
things
take out of this race.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure. A last quick question for both parties interested in trying to reach the common working man, the common working woman. What work is there left for them to do, for Republicans, for Democrats, both?
Well, I guess there's not a quick response to that, right? I mean, I don't know who the common working man or common working woman is.
Well, that
is,
looks
right?
like
I mean,
a lot of different things, for sure.
Right. So the country's really diverse, and our political identity is up in the air a bit. It's I think that what we are hungry for is someone to step up and articulate a vision that does bridge some of these gaps. That and so, you know, that's perhaps a restatement of your question, and I don't have the answer to that.
And I'm going to restate it as well in terms of some different terminology. And rather than common working man, common working woman, I think our lines really these days are urban, suburban, rural.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so the question becomes—
And race.
Yeah. Without doubt. Yeah. I was just going in terms of the geographic
yep.
side
yep.
of things.
Yep.
And so how do you then reach, for the Democrats in particular, right? They have a particular problem reaching rural areas.
Right. Well, there's the big cultural differences right
oh, yeah.
now in the country. But I think how do you bring people together? I mean, we all desire security, right? Nobody wants the country to be attacked. Nobody wants crime to go up. We all want opportunity to improve and to expand and to move into areas that are struggling with a lack of opportunity. And so, I mean, for either party to kind of promote those kinds of things, right? Clean air, clean water, improving economic circumstances. Those are the kinds of things that I think will play well broadly.
Hmm. That's a nice phraseology there.
And a lovely note on which
indeed.
To end what's been a lively conversation. And I do appreciate the fact that there was a lot to cover and a lot to take away, as you said, Jeff, from a really complex and fascinating midterm election. And it is gratifying that so many people came out to vote and that so many people took such a fervent interest in this. And I really appreciate each of you getting up bright and early on this Wednesday morning to come into the studio to offer your perspective on what ensued last night. Professor Jeff Roberg, Professor Jerry Mast, my thanks to both of you for being part of the morning show today. It's always
thank
a pleasure.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome, Greg.
Thank you. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert will pay her monthly visit to the program. We're going to be talking about the joys of composting, and in particular, the prospects of composting in a very big way coming to the village of Sturtevant. On Friday, Herschel Kruger from the theater department at Carthage will be joining us, and via telephone, Oscar-winning playwright Eric Simonson, talking about the brand new play, Up and Away, that receives its world premiere this coming weekend at Carthage as part of their New Plays initiative, celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. A very poignant look at the opioid crisis in rural America.
The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. The time is 8:59.